It's a completely different lifestyle. I used to have a very high credit score, and you know, now it's gone way downhill. I am trying to get a reduced pass bus fare because I'm a low in, or you know, on the poverty level, and it took me a week to get the application, and then I have to bring it down to Metro, and it'll take another couple of weeks. So it's getting things done is difficult. It's not like before I could hop in my car and go somewhere and go fix something.
New numbers out this week show that despite our improving economy, about 20% of people in our area live in poverty. That's one of the highest rates of any metropolitan region in the nation. There's poverty, and then there's people with absolutely nothing. They often end up here in downtown Los Angeles on Skid Row and at the Midnight Mission, where you can always get a free meal. Dinner time begins at 4:30. By then, on a sweltering summer afternoon, the line for food stretches for nearly an entire block.
We got chicken, potatoes, we got vegetables, a nice salad, and some good fresh bread.
That's more meals than at any other time since the Great Depression.
3 years ago, we got very close to 1 million meals. Then 2 years ago, we surpassed 1 million meals. We did it again last year. And this year, we're on track to be a little over 1.1 million meals.
Larry Adamson is president and CEO of the Midnight Mission. He says the vast majority of people seeking help struggle with mental illness and addiction. That's been the case for decades. But some of the people crowding the mission's cafeteria now don't fit that profile. They're the economic casualties, people who have had jobs in homes most of their adult lives. Larry Adamson noticed more of them showing up about a year and a half ago.
First, they survive on whatever they had left. So that maybe carries them the 2 or 3 months or the 6 months or whatever. Then they go to family. But guess what? That can't be permanent. And then when they fall out of the final safety net, then we see them.
Now we're 5 years into the economic recovery, but there's been no let-up in the people seeking help here. In LA County, there's been a 15% increase in homelessness in the past 3 years. They are the hidden homeless, staying with families, friends, or in cars, avoiding the streets and shelters. That is, until the bottom falls out, like it did for Jean Ellingen.
It's just a personal tent. I say it's about maybe 8 feet long.
Jean is 52 years old. She's white. And today she's dressed like a corporate professional in a fitted black dress and black heels with pointy toes. I first thought she was a PR woman for the mission when we met.
I have, you see here, it's a steel on the bottom.
She's lucky in a way because she's been given a tent. Well, it's really just a place to sleep. It's the length and width of a twin bed covered with green canvas.
On one end, I have my suitcases with all my belongings in them. So there's plenty of room for me to sleep.
Her tent is in the mission's courtyard, which is perpetually crowded with people hanging out, talking, smoking, and just waiting. Jean grew up in a middle-class family in Minneapolis. She never pictured herself ending up here.
I had my real estate license and kind of ready to take the real estate world by storm, and I couldn't get any clients soon enough, and I started running out of money. The financial problem started about this time 2 years ago, and I officially became homeless in January of 2013.
Jean doesn't have a husband, boyfriend, or children, so she decided to come to Los Angeles to stay with friends. And for months, she couch surfed, but finally, she had nowhere else to go. She's been here at the mission for 4 months. Single people like Jean aren't the only ones who are economically vulnerable. About 12% of LA County's homeless are families. For parents and children on the edge, it only takes one big setback to become part of that statistic.
All I know is one day we were taken from our apartment, and we were already unpacking and moving out, and we're living in a shelter now, which is better than nothing.
12-year-old Christian Caudio shared a one-bedroom apartment in El Monte with his parents and 6 siblings until earlier this year. That's when Christian's father was laid off from the Sriracha hot sauce factory. They couldn't make rent. Now they eat at the Midnight Mission and sleep at a different Skid Row shelter. Still dressed in his school uniform, Christian eats an early dinner with his parents.
They don't exactly have comfortable beds, but they have these things called cots where you unfold them, and it's basically like a whole bunch of metal poles sticking out to hold up this one cloth.
So do you have friends there in the shelter?
Yeah, a few.
And when you have friends at your school and you want to hang out with them, where do you hang out?
I don't really hang out. I just read books. I like to read books so much that at recess and lunch, I don't hang out with anybody. I just sit there and read.
Once someone falls into homelessness, the obstacles to climbing back out can pile up quickly, especially in an expensive city like Los Angeles, where the average renter spends half of his income on housing. A recent UCLA study found that LA has the most unaffordable rental market in the nation. The Midnight Mission CEO Larry Adamson says that means people can remain stranded on Skid Row even after they've kicked drugs and alcohol or found jobs.
I have men in our program here that are ready to graduate and ready to move on, but without there being some kind of a subsidized housing for them to first move into till they can build a greater income, they're stuck.
And yet, thousands of luxury apartments and condos have sprung up all around the Midnight Mission in recent years, with more on the way. There's never been a more visible gap between the haves and the have-nots in downtown Los Angeles. 23-year-old Thomas Martinez straddles that divide.
Right now, we're outside of my restaurant that I work at. It's called Little Bear Pub. It's not a full-time job. I'd say about 35, 36 hours a week. What they pay me here is $10.50. I'm actually in search of another part-time job just to, you know, compensate.
He works at a Belgian beer bar and restaurant just a mile from the Midnight Mission.
I'm actually one of the lead cooks. I actually attended culinary school for about a year and 6 months. I didn't graduate, unfortunately. That's only due to financial issues. And I guess my aspiration is to, you know, be a chef later in the future.
Thomas shares a studio apartment with a friend, but money is tight. And when he can't afford food or can't get a meal at work, he goes to the Mission.
You know, people don't want to really say, oh, I go eat at the shelter, or I go eat at the homeless shelter, or anything like that. But I see it more as sometimes you need help. When I went down there the first time ever, I really couldn't believe that our community and our city weren't helping people enough. Because down the street, you see people struggling and having to sleep in the street. And then you come up here and there's people buying $50, $80 lunches.
It's shocking to see the disparity up close. Just around the corner from the high-end lunch crowd, more than 3,000 people live on the streets. For blocks and blocks, you can see them milling around with their belongings piled high on shopping carts or sleeping in makeshift tents on the sidewalk. Many of them visibly mentally ill. The city and county recently teamed up on a new plan to help them. They offered people on Skid Row health services and moved about 60 of them into housing last month. But most of that housing is temporary. And the city and county are still a long, long way from their goal, providing permanent, safe, affordable housing to the people who need it most, a place where they can maybe start over. We just took a trip to Skid Row in a story that's part of our Fault Line series, examining poverty, wealth, and the gap in between. Now let's take a closer look at what can be done to create more affordable housing in Los Angeles. Some California cities like West Hollywood and San Diego have laws requiring developers to include some affordable units in their projects. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio announced this month that he'll require more developers to include affordable units starting next year. So with all its new construction, why doesn't LA do the same thing? Anna Scott is a producer on our program. She's looked into this question and she's here now. Hello.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, why doesn't LA require developers to develop at least some affordable housing?
Well, we have tried. It should be said first that there has never been the political will to create that kind of requirement. This goes all the way back to the 90s when Reardon tried it, then Villaraigosa tried to revive the idea, but it never got through the city council. But the real nail in the coffin came in 2009. Before that, we did manage to create a requirement like that in a small piece of downtown called City West, which is the western end of downtown. And there's a developer, Jeff Palmer, who's built numerous apartment buildings in that area. And he sued the city when they tried to impose this requirement on him. He said, I'm a private developer using private money. It's illegal to force me to build these units. And he won. And the city appealed it, and he won again. And then the California Supreme Court rejected the case when the city tried to take it to them. So the ruling stands, and LA has not been able to create that kind of mandate because of that.
Well, what about at the state level? Is there anything the legislature can do?
There was a bill last year to supersede the Jeff Palmer case, but Jerry Brown vetoed that in October. He said that it would quash development more than anything, and that it just really wouldn't be worth it, that it wouldn't create enough affordable housing to take the risk that developers would just stop building altogether.
So tell us a little bit more about Jeff Palmer. He is controversial.
Yes, he's kind of the man that everybody likes to hate in downtown LA. I mean, you know, he's known for building these sort of faux Italian villa inspired fortress type apartment buildings that have gotten a lot of flack because people think they're ugly.
The Orsini is one of
them. The Orsini, the Medici, they have names like that. He also has been very unapologetic about this particular issue of not wanting to build affordable housing, and people have taken issue with that. Earlier this year, he got attention for when he got permission from the city to build a pedestrian bridge over in one of his new developments that would go over a homeless encampment nearby, and he again got flack for that. So he's kind of become this face of the unfeeling downtown developer. But it should also be said that he's one of the first people to put residential apartment buildings in that neighborhood back in the late 90s. He's one of the pioneers of the downtown renaissance and has invested hundreds of millions of dollars in downtown LA. So, but for better or worse, he has a very distinct reputation in Los Angeles, in downtown Los Angeles in particular.
All right. Anna Scott, producer here at Press Play. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. So that's the city. And let's turn now to what the county can do on the affordable housing front. Mark Trotz is director of Housing for Health for the Los Angeles Department of Health Services. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me.
My pleasure. All right. So we just heard about this developer filing a lawsuit successfully to prevent this requirement that they build affordable housing. So how can the county work around that and build its own housing, affordable housing for low-income people?
Yeah, I mean, certainly inclusionary zoning is one way, but it's not the only way. And the county and the Department of Health Services, who I work for, we're of the belief that there's a lot of housing in Los Angeles County. And not to say that there's not a housing shortage for people with limited income and homeless people, but there are still a lot of housing units. And we're not waiting until somehow we miraculously build ourselves out of this problem. And so we're looking at the whole vast array of housing that already exists and trying to make that available to homeless people.
And how do you do that?
Well, one of the most important tools that we're utilizing is this new rent subsidy program that we got approved with the help of the County Board of Supervisors. And it basically it's similar to the federal Section 8 program, but it's a local housing subsidy, and it provides the rental subsidy that a homeless person needs to get into housing.
Do you have enough money in that program to help? There's a large population, as we just reported on, of homeless people. Do you have enough money to get a significant portion of them into affordable housing?
Well, our goal is to do 10,000 units in 5 years. And will that house every homeless person throughout the county? No, but we're specifically focusing on a population that the health department is most concerned about, and that is an extremely vulnerable and chronically ill population that's on the street. And so it's not the answer to the entire affordability spectrum, but it should address, and what our hope is, that it's going to address the most chronically homeless, the most visibly homeless, the people that other residents living downtown and others associate with, you know, sort of intractable street population.
Right. So the people you see on Skid Row.
Yeah, the people you see on Skid Row, the people that you see in other parts of downtown, in front of the thriving businesses and so forth.
Well, is that the impetus then, that because downtown has become so thriving, as you say, and lots of apartment buildings going up, lots of wealthier people moving in there, restaurants, nightclubs, etc., that is the impetus to get homeless people off the streets there?
Well, I think that's one impetus, and it's not the Department of Health Services' primary impetus, although I think, you know, we're happy that it will serve that need. But our main reason for, as a health department, for being in the housing business is that we believe that housing is healthcare when you look at it in the broad sense. And so our real motive and desire is, as an entity that is responsible for the health and well-being of all citizens in Los Angeles County, is to go right to the heart of the issue, to the folks who are struggling the most in their lives. And we know that the only way to improve their health care and to improve is to provide housing. And the alternative to that really is this continuing recycling through emergency rooms, through the acute hospital, back to the streets, to shelter, which does the homeless person no good and is also a very expensive solution.
But that's 10,000 people in 5 years. The estimation is that LA County needs 500,000 below market units to house all its most vulnerable citizens, not just people on the streets, but others who are close to being on the streets. Is there a plan to house the rest?
I mean, there's other agencies within the county and the cities of Los Angeles that are working on that sort of larger affordability issue. And admittedly, we're working on this sort of chronic homeless population. And if we can house 10,000 people in a short period of time of this population, we feel will make a meaningful and significant and visible dent in what people deem of, you know, consider this unending situation of homelessness in downtown and in other parts of the county.
Mark Trotz, director of LA County's Housing for Health program, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
All right, we want to hear from you. Have you had problems affording housing in Los Angeles? Please leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can leave a comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, it's Friday, and so it's film day. We'll tell you which movies you should see, which you should skip this weekend. That's coming up next on Press Play.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, you could sit in your air-conditioned apartment and make your own popcorn this weekend, but I guess you probably don't have one of those pump-action liquid butter dispensers in your kitchen. You'd better go to the movies. And we have reviews of the new releases coming at you. James Rocky reviews film for The Wrap, film.com, and others. Welcome back.
Thank you very kindly, Madeline.
You're very welcome. Christy Lemire is back, too. She co-hosts the movie review show What the Flick.
Hello there. Hi.
All right. Let us start with the big action flick, the Liam Neeson action flick. It's called A Walk Among Tombstones.
I can't let you leave here. They'll kill me if I do.
Who's they, Jones?
The other two.
So what? You're going to stab me now with that big knife?
It's going to bother me, too, for a long time. I know it will.
How much is it going to bother you? I take that knife away and stick it in your neck.
Could you really do that?
Yeah, I really could. But I'd rather not.
All right, Liam Neeson playing a private detective chasing down leads to a serial killer or something like that.
Right. So yet again, Liam Neeson plays a man with a very particular set of skills, not unlike the Taken movies or Nonstop or whatever. This is in its own genre, a Liam Neeson later in life kind of great action thriller. He works for skeevy people. And Scott Frank wrote and directed this, who also did The Lookout. And it's rich in detail and rich in character. And I liked it.
So this is the old trope of the private detective who's been kicked out of the force for a bad act who needs to redeem himself?
Maybe not kicked out.
Well, this is actually based on one of a series of novels by Lawrence Block, who's one of the great unsung American crime writers of the 20th century. He's been writing crime since the 1950s, and he's been writing the Scudder novels since 1976. And Scott Frank has taken a 1991 novel and placed it in 1999. So it is a little bit retro. It's a little bit of old New York. But also, there's a lot of thematic stuff in it about what's coming for the city and what's coming for all of us. And it winds up being a story about how do you battle monsters who happen to wear human faces. They're trying to sell it like Taken. It's got more in common with Beowulf, this sort of urban noir version of Beowulf.
There's a lot of dread in it because Y2K is coming. And we don't yet have 9/11.
Y2K is coming, and horrible things happen to good people, and horrible things happen to horrible people. But again, Lawrence Block, as a writer, is obsessed with mortality and morality. The protagonist is in AA, and that winds up becoming a great metaphor for moral choice and how you live your life on a daily basis.
Okay, let's just get the plot outlines with this movie and just give that idea.
Okay, so he is hired to look for the people who kidnapped the wife of a drug dealer. Right, so he's working for somebody who is kind of dubious, but he doesn't really care at this point who he takes money from.
Because the kidnappers not only kidnapped the drug dealer's wife and took the ransom, they returned the wife dead in pieces. And it's not something they haven't done before, we learn. And the idea of these sort of two predators preying on people who cannot go to the police and stealing the women from their lives to hurt, harm, and kill them really runs through the film in this mournful, sad way.
Right. So what you're saying is that this kind of rises above the genre picture of a, you know, outsider cop trying to make the world a better place, kind of a Charles Bronson death wish.
Yeah, it's complicated.
It's got a lot of great thematic and visual stuff going on in it as well. I mean, they're selling it as Taken 4, but it's like being told you're going to get a burger and being delivered steak. This is really good stuff.
It's more complicated than a Taken film, and it shot beautifully. I'm going to butcher the cinematographer's name, Mihai Malamar Jr.?
Who also shot Mihai Malamar Jr., okay. Who also shot The Master mm-hmm. for Paul Thomas Anderson. And it's all just before winter, and the trees are barren, and the branches are, in the words of Sonnet 73, bare ruined choirs where late the sweet bird sang. It's a great moody movie.
Okay, let's move on to another, what looks like another moody movie, The Maze Runner, kind of what Lord of the Flies meets Hunger Games.
Yes, it is yet another film based on yet another young adult novel in which it is a rigidly structured dystopian future where one plucky teen dares to think for himself and shake things up and start a revolution. You may have heard this story before.
Okay, here's a clip from the movie.
This is all we got. What's out there?
We only have three rules. First, do your part. Second, never harm another glader. Most importantly, never go beyond those walls.
Let me guess, they go beyond those walls.
They do. As you know, you were saying that this is a young adult adaptation where the YA could also stand for yet another. And I feel like this is the performers in this are great. The direction is striking. They clearly push the budget to the limit. And unfortunately, however, the script and story are not there. It's this endless series of reversals and surprises that start to feel like the rambling elaborations of a bad liar, all designed to get you to the next film in a 2-hour-long act of throat clearing.
The ending is terrible.
The ending is table-flippingly bad. But the last time I endured this much of people just making stuff up was when I watched Lost. So yeah, it just the film requires such powerful puppeteers that you can't help but feel a little jerked around by it.
I dug it for a long time, though, and it's cast really well. Dylan O'Brien is the Maze Runner of the title, and he's great looking, but he's also very solid in this, does not overplay it. It's cast really well with all the supporting characters, although they're all types.
Will Poulter from Son of Rambo and We're the Millers plays the young man who would rather feed the Minotaur than fight the Minotaur.
Yeah, he's the bully.
Yeah, there's good stuff in it. I just wish everyone involved had a different script to work from.
I love the way it looks. I love that there's like a very tactile kind of rough-hewn texture to it, unlike the glossy kind of high-tech movies we often see in this genre.
The maze itself is built like something Albert Speer would love, and that's really, really great.
And the sound design is great.
Great sound editing. Yes. That's very much a standout.
Okay, moving on to another movie. This one is probably aiming at an entirely different audience. This is Where I Leave You, and it stars Tina Fey, Jason Bateman, and Jane Fonda.
Whoops, we've come apart there, Mom. Can you please close that robe, please? Cover it.
Just breasts, Judd. Same ones you suckled at.
No, Mother, those are not the same breasts you nursed us with. Those are different. Those are, you got bionic breasts now.
I love you, Judd.
But?
What do you mean, but?
There's always a but when you say I love you. Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I don't know how you all got so repressed.
All right, James, give us the plot outline.
Based on a best-selling novel by a very good novelist, Jonathan Tropper, a patriarch dies and a family gathers in the space created by his absence. It's inspired drama from the ancient Greeks to the modern WASPs, and we get it again here as the far-flung...
Although they play a Jewish family.
They are a Jewish family. I was just giving that as an example
Shiva,
of range. They're
right.
Sitting Shiva, as the one character says, wasn't Dad an atheist Jew? And the answer is, he wanted you to sit Shiva. But what's great about this is the cast, which is full of very strong people like Adam Driver, Jason Bateman, Jane Fonda, Tina Fey. The only problem is that the book gets a little bit compressed in bringing it to the screen. It feels a little too jokey, a little bit too much like a situation tragedy. Also, Adam Driver steals the film as the family's black sheep. He's this weirdly magnetic figure.
Like he is in Girls.
Like he is everywhere.
I kind of hated this movie.
I
found
it
mawkish and false and cringe-inducing. No one is a real person, especially the women. They're all drawn in really empty, flimsy ways. Connie Britton is just a cougar. Jane Fonda is just the inappropriate mom. Jason Bateman's wife, who cheats on him, who begins his journey of self-discovery, is just treated horribly. Tina Fey, the brilliant Tina Fey, gets nothing to play here. She's barely even a person. It veers wildly between wacky slapstick and sticky sentimentality. I hated this movie.
All right. I think that's all we can say, Ben. we're going to move on to some movie news. And it looks like the Bourne movie franchise will reappear once again with Matt Damon. Are we happy about that?
Matt Damon and Paul Greengrass, one of the original directors. I don't know how you feel about this. I just think that Universal is one of a few studios without a huge franchise, aside from a Fast and Furious, which took a blow with the death of Paul Walker. But Universal isn't Disney. Universal isn't Warner Brothers. They don't have a superhero or a science fiction franchise, and they'd really like to have one. And I think that Bourne might be their best shot. I mean, the man who created the Bourne novels has been dead for about 20 years, but he's still publishing things. So goodness knows this is a franchise with creaky zombie legs. But I'd rather see both Damon and Greengrass do something new.
Yeah, I loved all the Bourne films, and I felt very satisfied by the Bourne Ultimatum. And I feel like as a trilogy, it is self-contained, and it works beautifully.
I'm not sure I need more. The end of the last film comes back visually and thematically to the first film, even though it was by a different director, and you go, thank you. That ties everything off nicely, and I can move on.
All the answers are there. I like their pairing. I like the kinetic nature of Greengrass's filmmaking with this character, with this setting, but I don't need any more.
Yeah.
Well, in that vein, there will be another 007 movie, another James Bond movie starring Daniel Craig yet again. And what do you think about that? Do you think it's time for a new Bond?
Nope. I love Daniel Craig.
All right.
Bring us more Daniel Craig.
Daniel Craig does the whole thing of Her Majesty's sociopath very well. He's like a leg breaker in a suit. The bigger problem with the Bond films right now is a screenwriting team of Wade and Purvis, who've been on board since the Brosnan days and have really kind of driven it down. I feel like until the Bond movies get out of the hands of the Broccolis, who have said, for example, you'll never have an R-rated Bond film, it's going to be a lot of lather, rinse, repeat. I think Skyfall was beautiful. It also felt more like a Batman film than a Bond film. And I really need those movies.
I mourn the death of humor in the latest Bond movies. There's no playfulness anymore. It's deadly serious, it seems.
And it's weird because you are talking about geopolitics and espionage in our modern era. But yeah, you can have a little bit of fun, and that might be welcome. Actually, if they are looking for a new Bond, there's a great movie out right now called The Guest with Dan Stevens from Downton Abbey. And he does all his own fight scenes. And watching that, I thought, oh, that could be a new 007.
I think we need to talk about Dan Stevens because he's in that Liam Neeson movie as a villain, right?
He's the drug dealer whose wife gets kidnapped.
Cousin Matthew, what has happened to you?
Cousin Matthew is a real actor, and that's terrific. In The Guest, he does a great action comedy suspense thing. He does Low Life very well. He's a really talented actor, and seeing him out of a tuxedo looking longingly across a parlor at Lady Mary is actually a bit of a relief.
I have to disagree with you there. We're just going to leave it there. I miss Cousin Matthew as Cousin Matthew. And not a psychopath. All right. James Rocky, reviewing films for The Wrap, Film.com, and others. And Christy Lemire, co-host of What the Flick on YouTube. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you, as
Thank
ever.
You. Thank you.
Coming up on the program, NPR's Carrie Kahn will be here. She's going to talk about her reporting in Mexico, where she's based. She's going to talk about why government officials there will not talk to her about their crackdown on migrants from countries further south. So we're going to have that story and a lot more after a news update with Cherry Glazer.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. The president has delayed action on an immigration overhaul until after the November midterm election. But in Mexico, officials are in the midst of the largest crackdown on illegal immigrants in decades. Just one reason the flow of Central American children into the U.S. has slowed from a torrent earlier this summer to a trickle now. The latest data from the Department of Homeland Security shows that the number of kids detained at the border in July was half the number from June. NPR's Carrie Kahn has been covering this story from pretty much ground zero all summer long, and she's based in Mexico City. We have the pleasure of welcoming her here in the studio. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. And so your most recent reporting on the border crisis takes place at the border, Mexico's border with Guatemala. Why has Mexico decided to go after immigrants from Central America?
That's a good question. If you ask the Mexicans, they'll say that it's part of a regional strategy. It's part of their responsibility to help out the region and help the situation. Critics all over Mexico, human rights advocates, analysts say that this is pressure from the U.S. that has put pressure on Mexico to crack down, because this is the transit area they're coming through. They have to travel through Mexico. And then if you do listen to the Mexicans, they say we need to bring order to the border. I've heard that for years along the U.S. southwest border. And in some ways, that's true. But the interesting part about the crackdown in Mexico, which is unprecedented, as you said, you nailed it on the head. It's been a laissez-faire. Let them come in. Whatever they do, we'll deal with it. But the crackdown is not at the border. And it's very interesting. You go actually to the border, which is separated. There's a river that separates Guatemala from Mexico. And people are coming on these huge rafts. There are these huge inner tubes with wooden pallets on top. And there isn't a immigration official or an army officer or anybody around for miles. And so what they're doing is they're allowing the immigrants to come as they have free across the border. And the crackdown begins hundreds of miles north of the border, which is
Really? Why? You would think that they would be diffused throughout the country at that point. It would be much harder.
Exactly. I have tried for months to talk with Mexican officials about this situation, their strategy, what's going on. I cannot get an answer from the Mexican officials. And it's quite interesting because I have had great access with this administration in other parts of the border where the army has been set in, where the military has been set in. In Tamaulipas, which is the border of southern Texas, I was allowed to go on a ride-along with the army in a tank. I had to wear a vest and I had to wear a helmet, and we were being chased by the narcos. You could hear them on the radio, and they told me it was too dangerous for me to go to some of their checkpoints.
The narcos were chasing the army tank?
They were following them on their radio. You could hear them saying, here they come, they're going down here, they're going left. And then we went into a community and they said, watch out, they're here. So we were being monitored by the narcos. I can't think of a more dangerous situation than that. I went in on a nighttime ride-along with the federal police in Michoacan at the height of the problems in Michoacan with the drug traffickers. And the army told me that it was too dangerous to go to a checkpoint in southern Mexico to see what was going on. So there is a very reticence on their part to discuss the strategy. It is not something that is well received in Mexico. Mexico has always been seen as the friendly neighbor. They are quick to criticize the United States for our wall that we build along the U.S. Southwest border. They do not want to be seen doing similar things. So Mexico does not want to be seen enforcing the border, no walls, no military right on the border. They allow them to come in. But they have set up unprecedented checkpoints along that road that takes them to the north, which more importantly takes them to where the train leaves southern Mexico. It's a couple hundred miles from the border. These are cargo trains that the migrants infamously climb on top, stow away on top, and can go all the way to the border. They're also impeding them from going on that train. This is the first time ever they've done that.
So that's really interesting. It's kind of like a stealth crackdown on these migrants. You spoke to a man who fled from El Salvador to Mexico for one of your stories for NPR. And let's just play a clip of tape of him with you translating.
Estaban pidiendo $300 cada mes, que si no me unía, pues ya iban a matar a mis dos hijas y a mi mujer.
They demanded $300 a month, or they would kill my wife and two daughters. Ruada says they put everything they could in one suitcase and ran.
So the they being gangs in El Salvador, he's fleeing, trying to get out of El Salvador to Mexico and eventually to the United States?
Yes. And what I saw in just the week that I was at the border was that migrants can easily come into Mexico, and a lot of them are still fleeing the same situations that are happening. I met Hondurans that were fleeing unspeakable violence there. I met children still coming across from Guatemala that were fleeing intense poverty. And so what happens is they're afraid to go to where those checkpoints are, a couple hundred miles north of the border, so they're staying in southern Mexico. Many are asking for political asylum, refugee status in Mexico. It's a very difficult path in Mexico to get refugee status. And the fear is if they get caught by migration officials in Mexico, they'll be quickly deported. In the last 2 months, June and July, Mexico deported 30,000 immigrants. So the advocates, human rights advocates, are very fearful that their cases are not being heard, their asylum petitions are not being reviewed properly.
So these migrants are coming from El Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala, but not Nicaragua, another Central American country that you have spent some time reporting in. Why not?
Nicaragua is a much different situation. It's a little farther south, so it's much more expensive. Nicaragua is one of the poorest countries in the hemisphere. I think it's the second or third. So people, when they're looking to flee Nicaragua, and they are leaving Nicaragua for poverty reasons, they go south. They go to Panama. They go to Costa Rica, where you can get a visa, where there is a large immigrant population, and their family members are there. There's a lot of different reasons. When Nicaraguans came to the U.S. in the 70s during the war in the U.S.-backed Contra War, they came legally. They got political asylum. They brought their families, so they're not trying for family reunification as much. But also the violence in Nicaragua is nowhere near violence in the other neighboring countries. It's a much different government there, and it's just not as violent there.
They don't have the criminal gang problem.
They do not. There are gangs. There is drug trafficking. I don't want to make it seem like it's a paradise, but it's nowhere near like it is in neighboring Honduras or El Salvador.
So let's talk a little bit about the drug war, because we haven't heard a lot about that in the media recently. We've heard a lot about this migrant story and not about what's happening with the drug cartel. So, you know, if you were to believe what you read in the U.S. press, you'd say, oh, well, that problem's taken care of because we're not hearing about it. But that's obviously not the case.
No, it's not. The drug war is still happening in Mexico. The Mexican government has made some amazing strikes at leaders of the cartels, especially the number one trafficker in the world, Chapo Guzman, who they got earlier this year. And the homicide rate is dropping. But what is happening in Mexico, that extortion and kidnapping is on the rise. And that's something that's troubling to everybody in Mexico right now. It's a very scary situation.
Okay, let's hear a little bit about that from a woman you interviewed for another story for NPR, a woman named Monica.
Kidnappers called at 12 at night and said if she didn't give them money, they would cut her husband's finger off and send it to her. Her husband was released after the family paid a sizable ransom, but she hasn't felt safe since. She thought about moving to the U.S., but she says she wants to stay and fight for a better Mexico. I keep working for Mexico, she says, but the government, what do they give me? Security? No, I don't have it.
So the cartel kidnappings are now targeting people who are not well off.
It's true that you could call it the democratization of kidnapping and extortion, because even where Monica works, she works in this huge warehouse district of goods and stuff that are sold in Mexico City. And she knows at least five people in that marketplace that have been kidnapped, including one of her box boys who was kidnapped for just a few hours for 1,000 pesos, which is about $85. And it's not necessarily cartel members, because what is happening in this kingpin strategy, when you eliminate the kingpins, the cartels splinter off and they become into smaller and smaller groups, and drug trafficking isn't as lucrative as it is. So they're diversifying into kidnapping, into extortion. And we see a lot of that right now. And people are not feeling, well, the homicide rate may be dropping and these spectacular crimes that we've heard of in years from Mexico may be less in the news. This kidnapping for, as you said, poorer people and more middle class people is very disturbing right now and a big challenge for the government.
Well, Carrie, there's so much to talk about, but we've run out of time, unfortunately. It's so great to have you. Thank you.
Thank you very much for having me.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn. She covers Central America for NPR. She's based in Mexico City. And also happy to have in the studio with me right now, Jolie Myers with the feedback. Happy Friday.
Thank you. Happy Friday, Madeline.
Thank you.
So you went out to the Midnight Mission,
yep.
And we really got a sense of how close we all are to basically living in the Midnight Mission. It's a crazy piece, really nicely done. Our listener, Leonora, called in to share her story. She really identified with the first woman in our story, the woman who had the real estate license. She was dressed up in like a black pencil mm-hmm. dress for the interview. Here's what she had to say.
I'm one of these people who are close to being homeless. I'm 50 years old, recently divorced, have some health problems myself. I have not only a college degree, I have a post-college degree. And still cannot find work. I can't find help. It takes 2 to 3 years to get housing subsidized in L.A. County through Section 8. There's just no options. I'm living with a friend. It's absurd because it's not going to last. I'm stuck. Anyway, I don't know what the solution is. Still searching for myself.
So it just kind of shows how widespread this problem really is. Tina A. heard our story, and she tweeted that it made her get up from her desk and act. She just donated to the Midnight Mission. So hopefully there's people out there that are hearing this and jumping in to help.
That's fantastic.
It's good news. So
yeah.
Another story we did today on a different and more uplifting note. We had our movie roundup in the show today, and there was talk that Cousin Matthew should perhaps be the next Bond. You put the kibosh on that. So we wanted your suggestions for who should play Bond next. One of our public radio neighbors to the north weighed in. The CBC's Stephen Quinn scoffs at bringing in a new Bond. Do we need to replace Daniel Craig? No. Next question. But our friends over at Studio 360 tweeted Team Idris Elba. And I have to say, I very much support that idea.
Team Stringer Bell. Bring it.
Stringer Bell. Stringer Bond.
Stringer Bond. Love it. All right, Jolie Myers, thank you very much.
Of course.
Have a great weekend.
You too.
Support for Press Play comes from the Kane Foundation, Rick and Suzanne Kane, and Jenny, Maggie, and Sari Kane.